Hello and welcome to this arena special with playwright Marina Carr, coming to you live this evening from the Project Arts Centre in Dublin. She's not afraid of blood, nor of rage, nor of death. She's fearless when it comes to excavating the human condition. Her plays, from The May to By the Bog of Cats to Portia Coughlin, give a nod towards the Greeks and their heroines Medea and Electra. But Carr's women are also rooted to the landscape of the Irish Midlands, its rivers, its bogs and its lakes. And in this year's Dublin Theatre Festival, she focuses on one of the great Greek heroines, Hecuba, Queen of Troy, and wrestles Hecuba's story and legacy from the Greek playwright Euripides. Please welcome Marina Carr. Great to see you here and to have you on the programme this evening, Marina. Hecuba, Queen of Troy. We meet her at the beginning of this adventure you bring us on. Troy is sacked. It's devastated at this point. She's in a very precarious situation. Why did you want to tell her story, and why did you want to tell it at this moment in her story, the moment that you chose?
Well, I suppose I have a fascination with the myths, the ancient myths, and as I got a bit longer in the tooth, I disagreed with Euripides' rendering of Hecuba. What you have to remember is when Euripides sat down to write his Hecuba in circa 500 BC, 700 odd years, if not longer, had already elapsed. So he was dealing with myth. And you also have to realise he was dealing with a very particular political situation in Athens at the time. It was, you know, trying to start a country, trying to found a city-state, and basically trying to control all the citizens, men, women and children. So a lot of these Greek plays were what you could call salutary tales. And if you look at them, the roles for the women are magnificent. But the women are all doomed, finally. If you look at the Orestia, or, you know, Clytemnestra, if you look at Hecuba, if you look at Jocasta and Oedipus, if you look at Phaedra, if you look at Antigone, these are all women who apparently transgress, who take power into their own hands. And it seems as if the founding fathers of the Athenian state were trying to send out some kind of
message.
I don't know, or analysis even. I think they were too interesting to be into messages. The playwrights, not the city fathers,
right.
But I think a lot of it was about controlling of women.
Well, so I suppose in the classic version, or in the Euripides version of the Hecuba story, we find her, you know, her son Paris is supposedly the man who started the whole trouble with Helen of Troy. We'll come back to Helen and Paris in a second.
Yeah.
But to see where she's at, what might be motivating her actions, she in the duration of this play, she will lose a daughter she absolutely loves in a ritual sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
She will find out that a son that she adores, in fact, hasn't been protected as she thought, but is now dead. He's her youngest son, and there's this kind of feeling that she absolutely adores that youngest son, maybe in a way she doesn't adore others. And therefore, she is very angry at those who have not protected, in particular, that younger son, and she takes her revenge out on them. Killing that man, Polymestor, isn't it?
Polymestor, who would have been her son-in-law.
Yeah, so she kills her grandchildren, essentially. Is what the story Euripides tells.
So she blinds Polymestor and has her women and is involved in the killing of those two little boys. So I was, you know, you do a little bit of research and there's so many myths around Troy and Hecuba and Priam and Agamemnon and all of it. So I just thought, how about another look, you know, because in a way, we in the West, we are living out that Greek idea of the city-state and its interpretation and its ideas around how men and women should conduct themselves. And I'm not sure it's all good, to be honest. Because, you know, they say, it's the cliche, history is written by the winners. But I think myths are also written by the winners. So essentially, what was happening was an ancient myth, a 1200 BC myth of Troy, this queen, this fabled queen, was taken and kind of, I mean, I don't want to say propaganda because I love Euripides and I think he was far bigger than that. But I think there is a way that over time things get interpreted badly or they get interpreted to suit a certain agenda. And I just wanted to push, you know, push at that a little bit and see what if we talked about how Hecuba may have suffered? What if we talk about how conflicted Agamemnon is as the head of, it wasn't Greece then, they were just warring factions who arrived on this beach at Troy, 40 kings, Homer says, one more vicious than the next. And how tightly kings were controlled and how Agamemnon was hated. You see, I've always loved Agamemnon because I think he's got really bad press also because I know it's a difficult thing to say, but I actually have because I think he was a Spartan. He was Mycenaean, but he was brought up by Tyndareus in Sparta, who was the father of Helen and Clytemnestra. And he marries Clytemnestra. But it's impossible to underestimate, so the experts tell me, it is impossible to underestimate how much the Athenians hated the Spartans at the time the Oresteia and the Hecuba and all these plays were written. So they were very political statements. Mm. And then you go to the whole history of, you know, these theatre festivals they had. You had 4 days of the Dionysian festival, 4 days of plays. So at the break of day, everybody was in the theatre. Well, every boy and man. Only if you were a visiting foreign dignitary and a woman would you be allowed there. Athenian women would have been at home washing the dishes and plucking the chicken. You wouldn't have been there. But these were kind of tales on how to live and how not to live. So they were very political. Like the war orphans would be paraded. Meat would be cooked. It'd be the first time all year that some people would have eaten a bit of meat. Wine was drunk. And then you watch 3 tragedies and a satire play. So, for example, when the Oresteia begins and the watchman is talking about the sun rising in the first play of the Oresteia, Agamemnon, the sun is literally rising in the theatre.
When they're watching.
You know? Yeah. I mean, talk about a collation of life and art. I mean, absolutely incredible. And it must have been astonishing to be there. And 16,000 people. The actors were all men. They wore these incredible masks. They wore high heels. They could be heard at the top. 16,000 people had to hear them. So the voice training must have been absolutely magnificent.
And the theatres themselves, incredibly acoustic.
Yeah,
incredibly.
I stood in Epidaurus. Some people call it Epidaurus. And yes, there's a point you stand in and you can speak and everyone can hear you. It is magical. It's extraordinary.
But you say that Agamemnon has had bad press, but Agamemnon, he's had to sacrifice his own daughter, so that must have, you know, obviously weighed heavily on his shoulders.
Yeah.
But there also is a point here where he has to sacrifice one of the daughters of Hecuba.
Yeah.
And he's there, you know, he answers the rabble's call. He kind of gives them what he wants. He's the populist politician of the day. Could he not have stood up and said, no, this is wrong, I'll take the consequences. That's heroic. That's honourable.
Yeah, well, that's the other side. But then the other thing, you see, there are many iterations of the Greek legends. And in Homer, there is no mention of Agamemnon ever sacrificing his own daughter or Polyxena. So it goes through many.
Polyxena being Hecuba's, the daughter that he has to sacrifice.
Daughter of Hecuba, Hecuba's youngest daughter. So it depends on what version you're reading and depends on what period you're reading it in. So I find all of that fascinating and very difficult to navigate. So you kind of, in one way it's gorgeous because you have this palette and you say, I'll have a bit of this, I'll have a bit of this, and I'll have a bit of this. So I'm not, you know, I'm not saying the way I see it is the right way. It's just the way I see it.
But you did say that, you know, Euripides was dealing within a very specific political situation when he wrote told his version of the play.
Yeah.
So what is it about the current political situation, our current politics? You talk about city-states, but specifically, what is it about now that made this the right time for you to give your rendering of Hecuba?
Well, I just think it's a very interesting time because we are actually living out the savagery. You know, Yeats talks about this all the time. And, you know, Maud Gonne was kind of... Troy was his metaphor for Maud Gonne in a way. And he talks about, you know, that we all lost something terrible when that beautiful civilization was destroyed. And it was burnt to the ground. And then you had the next iteration of it in Rome, which was a lot harsher. And then we have taken that, if you look at law and the way it has come down. So you go from the Minoans and then the Cretans and then... the Trojans had their own versions, you know, the East and all of that. And then you come to Rome, and then you come to what we've inherited through Magna Carta, and basically the experts will pull me up on this. But basically, the way I see it in broad strokes is we you know, Magna Carta was all about just keeping the king in line, which is what they're at with Agamemnon, keeping him in line. So what we are dealing with here right now is just like slight variations and little constitutional, you know, fixes on essentially what came out of Athens, the idea of the state and the rights of the individual. And of course, the Athenian state was great for some people, but it wasn't great for a lot of people. It wasn't great for slaves, and generally wasn't great for a lot of children either. So there's a lot there that I think you could put that on to any contemporary society and say, well, okay, let's look at ourselves. What's not so great about this society? You know, some things are improving, but other things are disimproving.
But when you talk about, you know, keeping the king in line, I suppose there are two men of various hairstyles that spring immediately to mind when you talk about that. but you wrote this play back in 2015.
Yeah.
So we're a little bit ahead of...
Yeah, well, I mean,
both those kings.
I am not prophetic. I have no interest in anything like that. But I think because the blueprint is so strong, and what's coming down. Because after all, these three great tragedians, and I'm talking about Aeschylus, Sophocles and Euripides, they were magnificent writers. And I have to say, in many ways, they were the first feminists, because they gave volition, they gave voice, and they gave power to their women characters. Of course, they were all doomed. They'd probably be doomed anyway. But at least they got to articulate the doom very eloquently before they went down. And I think that was probably a new note. And I think if you examine very carefully what those three playwrights were at, was kind of a criticism of what they were living through.
But ultimately, didn't they make the lesson also, wasn't it given to the men who were watching, kind of keep your women in line?
First thing, you start a country, sort out the women.
Yeah, don't let them start
acting up. Yeah,
because you're going to land in trouble.
Yeah, you're going to land in trouble.
That's not a very feministic attitude, though, on their part, is it?
No, it's not. But also, I you know, you have to question the degree of savagery which the women in these plays go to. And you have to wonder how true that is. Because if you go back to the myths again, there are several versions of Agamemnon in the bath. Was it actually his wife who killed him? Was it not her lover? Was it not a palace coup? We don't know. You know, Medea murdering the two children, Phaedra falling in love with the stepson. You know, they're all versions. And I think what we have been given one interpretation. But the wonderful thing about myth is I think that it is open to many interpretations.
But the great weapon of mass destruction in this story is Helen. Now, did the weapons of mass destruction exist or not? Which has been a question
we don't know. Yeah.
But you are questioning whether, in fact, the whole existence that Helen is purely a made-up story.
Well, that's, you know, when I was writing this, I think it was a few years after they'd gone into Iraq. And I'm not politically astute or anything like that. I'm a writer. I'm not a political commentator. But it did stick in my mind that they invented the weapons so they could go in. And then you go back to the myths and the legends, and they're all very, like, some of them say, no, Helen was never in Troy. that she was on some beach, I forget the name of the king, and that she was used as a reason to invade because they wanted to take what they needed to take. You know, whatever 12th century BC version of oil is, gold and grain and cattle and jewels and you know, whatever it was.
And might some of those kings possibly have believed the story about Helen, not, you know, that she was there, you know, the way, were there those who actually did believe there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq and therefore said, yes, we need to invade? You know, do you think those parallels are there?
I think they probably are. And I mean, the truth becomes a very malleable thing. And I think it's very, it gets more and more difficult for any of us to figure out what's going on. I, for one, have stopped reading newspapers, I'm ashamed to say, but actually I'm not that ashamed because I used to read 3 a day. And then what I figured out was the stories were all the same. All that was changing were locations. And I just got tired of it. And I think you're far better off going back to your classics and your stories. Mm-hmm. I know sometimes we love gossip, we love the new, and we always think it's new. But the longer you get in the tooth, you realise, actually, I've seen that story before. It was just elsewhere.
Same tune, different words.
Exactly, yeah.
Let's listen to a section from the play. This is from the current production, the Rough Magic production, which is happening here in the Project Arts Centre. And if you're listening at home, Marina coming to you live from the Project Arts Centre this evening with playwright Marina Carr on the occasion of Rough Magic's production of Hecuba. And playing the character of Hecuba in this production is Aisling McGuckin, and she's going to perform a section now from towards the end of the play, and this is around the section where she discovers about the young son that she loves so much.
I'm dreaming of our summer palace up in the high, cool mountains, the children splashing in the fountain. I'm woken by one of the servants, a Trojan girl. I think her mother was one of my dressmakers. "Shh," she says, and leads me through the many cloth rooms, a passageway, where outside the sea near. She points to something. "What is it?" I say. "Your son," she says, "the young prince, Polydorus." And she kneels, kisses my feet. "Poor queen," she says, "poor queen. Don't tell them it was me who showed you," and she runs off. There's a mound of them, piled like a haystack, the new dead, fresh dead since we landed here in Thrace. No smell yet. Small, stiff bodies, children mostly from what I can make out. Don't believe what I'm doing as I'm doing it, rummaging among them, looking for Polydorus. The doomed eyes, the ankle bones snapping, the fragile heads, some shorn, but most with the long silken tresses of our boys. How proud we were of our son's hair. Didn't cut it to shoulder length till they were 10. I whisper sorry. Sorry as I disturb them, though I feel it is they who pity me. And there he is, on his side, looking past me. They didn't even close your eyes. I gather him up. He resists me, doesn't want my embrace now, will never want it again. No breath, none. You knew you would come to this day. In you, from the start, all gone now. And something akin to relief comes flooding in. You can put aside motherhood now. Take it off like a scarf, let it swirl and flow away from you across the shining sea. Hold his hard little body. His lips, when you touch them, are ice. Who did this? Who did this to my war baby born in the first year of these unimaginable times? I must bear this too, it seems.
Aisling McGuckin,
Aisling McGuckin there in the part of Hecuba from towards the end of Marina Carr's version of this tale, which is currently running at the Project Arts Centre. Aisling, I'm wondering, you've been listening, I'm sure, to the conversation I've been having with Marina around this whole idea of rage, you know, and how the men are being shown, these women with rage. Even as you play her there, that's not a woman. Well, it doesn't sound to me as if she's a woman full of rage. How do you read her?
Well, by this point, one of the early things Marina said in rehearsals was the play is a journey to empty. And in a funny way, the only way to get to empty is to find all the pieces that have been beautiful, the things to hang on to, the things that are unbearable to lose. And strangely enough, towards the end of the play, we find a reminiscence, a love of a life that has been lost. So almost in the reverse, she finds here a moment it builds to release and relief, but mostly love for a life that was taken.
So in a sense, it's devastation.
A devastation, but only in the reliving of what was glorious. They're very close together. I think somewhere she knew that Polydorus was gone anyway. So in the last moment, she embraces at the lines of our boys. In that moment, to be able to see that hair, remember the smell,
It was one of the things that really struck me. I saw the production on Saturday afternoon, and it was that language and how it describes beautiful things like you do there, but also the horror of going through a mound of corpses, mm-hmm. or the horror, as we see, of describing a sacrifice, a ritual sacrifice of Hecuba's daughter, in fact. And one of the ways that that's done is, you had it at the beginning of that section where you're quoting what one of the women says, and can't remember the exact line, but at the end of it you say, "she says." Mm-hmm. And that happens quite a lot during the play. Sometimes the character on stage with you, in fact, either you're saying the lines that, well, she told me this or he told me this, even though the person is standing there. Mm-hmm. And equally, somebody else relates lines that you have said while you're standing there. What's that feeling as an actor, hearing your lines, if you like, being said by somebody else, this is what she told me?
What we're doing is fighting the narrative. Each character is trying to tell the story from their viewpoint, and it's an incredibly clear way of making that point, that we might hear somebody else use our words, but they're imbuing it with something that we might not remember. So there are many layers, and it made rehearsal really interesting, that you would hear your narrative back with somebody else's view on it. And you would then have to wait your turn to get them back with your next line. It's an incredible way of taking emotion out. You know, you could easily explode with pain from the first line of this play as Hecuba. But if you're arguing the narrative and your version, you can't. You have to stay strong to get the point across.
Well, thanks, Aisling. I know you're going to perform a little bit for us later on, so I'll let you take your seat back there. But that's very interesting, I think, what Aisling says there, Marina, because it struck me, that's what we're getting here in many ways. It's like the, I'll just go down, sit back down here. It's like, in some ways, you know, the family story where your brother or your sister says, "Now, do you remember?" And you came in and you said, "Give me the cup of tea." And he said, "Well, I didn't quite say give me the cup of tea. I said, can I have that cup of tea?" "Yeah, give me the cup of tea." That's what you said. "Well, not quite what I said." So is that part of what you were at? You know, this idea that when you're telling a story, there are so many versions of it. There is no one single truth.
Yeah, I suppose. But I mean, when I write, I don't really consciously think.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know what I've written till it's written, to be honest. The only thing I remember was at the time I was getting very frustrated with the limitations of dialogue. So I wanted the interior voice as well. I wanted to hear what they were thinking as they were saying. Because, you know, Sean, we go through most of our lives saying the opposite of what we think, just to survive, to get through the day. So I'm very, very interested in the interior, what's going on inside, why
while we're behaving ourselves or not behaving ourselves. And it's that idea of contradiction. And then, of course, if you have several people on stage with several voices going on and several contradictions, it makes, I think, for energy anyway. And there's no true line. It's just everyone's version.
Spending the most of our lives saying the opposite to what we think just to get through the day, does writing allow you then maybe to say what you really think, even if it's oblique? Not that you're consciously doing it, that obliquely you get to say what you're thinking without having to ram it down somebody's throat. Is that part of the reason behind
it? I think it is, yeah. I think it is. Or saying mostly what you think. I think it allows, it's a space where you can actually be true. But then, you know, we delude ourselves all the time. You know, you can even lie when you're writing. You know, you just have to be very, very careful. False notes creep in very, very quickly. So I think, I would say one would hope it would be a place.
And those false notes, is that some kind of internal editor who's at you, you know?
Yes.
And do you have to put him or her, whichever gender that editor is, on the one side?
Your fears around your place in the world, because we all have them, you know, one's identity. And who are we really? And where have we come from? You know, we're out of the clay, we're out of nature. But there's also something in us, there's some mysterious thing. There's some mysterious thing going on that we can't understand rationally. And the temptation is very often to dismiss what can't be understood by reason. But the longer I go on, the more I feel we're creatures of the earth with the bit of mystery, and that we feel everything first, or we instinctively know things first, and that reason comes after.
And as a writer then, as your career has progressed, is it easier to give in to the instinct than it was initially, or are you checking yourself more often?
No, I really don't care anymore if I'm just writing for myself, you know, over the bin. When I was younger, I was a lot more ambitious. Now I'm not. I think you have to give up. It's a surrender, and all I care now about is the writing. And if the plays are done, well and good. If they're not, I actually don't care that much anymore.
The act of writing, the sitting down at the desk and doing, that's all that's important.
That's
now.
The magic for me now. And that's not to diminish all these beautiful actors here. Mm. Of course I love having my plays done. I love having productions. But I think if you chase a thing too hard, it will elude you. I think you must let it come to you. And I think being quiet and just attending to your own business, and if it's going to come, it'll come.
So there isn't even a name for it to come. It's not that you're aiming for success by standing back and letting go. You're just saying, this is what it is.
This is what it is. This is what I have to write now.
Well, that kind of fits perfectly in with what Kevin O'Rahill is going to do for us, because I know you're a huge fan. I know that, yeah.
Massive fan, yeah. And absolutely honoured that he's playing here.
And when we were chatting with Kevin earlier, just before we came to her, we were saying, well, what will you play? And he said, I'll improvise.
Yeah, I'll make it up as you
I'll
go.
I'll do whatever I feel like at that moment. And I suppose that's what it is at the writing desk. Being in the moment, letting it come out, and worry about the editing after the event. So, Queven has given us a potential title here of ephemera, giving the ephemeral nature of what an improvisation is. So he's just tuning up the fiddle for us here in the Project Arts Centre, and he's ready to go. Thank you.
Vivian O'Rahala. We'll be back with more from the Project Arts Centre after this break. And welcome back to the Project Arts Centre in Dublin and this special programme on the work of playwright Marina Carr, whose Hecuba is being staged by Rough Magic as part of the Dublin Theatre Festival here in the Project Arts Centre. Kevin O'Rahala, who you heard playing just before the break, will be back with us before the end of the programme, as will Aisling McGuckin, playing the part of Hecuba in this production, which is going to do another little section for Marina's work for us later on. And I was saying during the ad break, Marina, I want to go back now to the Midlands and to Offaly and the Midlands plays, that early work, and we both said, as Keevan was playing, that's the sound of the Bog of Cats. That's where he brought us, by the Bog of Cats.
Conjured it up, the whole symphony. Yeah, it was magical, absolutely magical.
When you know, the Greeks, I suppose, you've said they've been on your mind for a long, long time, but those early plays, people always spoke about the Midlands and the Offaly accent and the kind of language that we're using there. How soon were the Greeks... You know, what was your first exposure to the Greeks? How early was it?
Oh, well, I mean, you know, the Ladybird series and the encyclopedias as children. We had them in the house and they were in the school. My mother was the principal in the school. And so there was access to all of that.
What kind of language was...
Very simple, but very straightforward. And then my mother loved mythology, Irish mythology and Irish history. And she was the principal teacher. And I was telling my students this earlier, because I teach in DCU in the School of English, but I was telling my students just before I came in here that because she was the principal and it was a national school in the middle of nowhere, it was like, you know, national school teachers then ran little kingdoms. So if the sun shone, off we went on a nature walk, you know, like off to the lake. And we'd have, you know, you bring your lunch or the picnic or whatever. But she would name all the trees for you, you know, and she would tell you all the legends about the place because she loved folklore and mythology. And then on a wet day, she'd start on a history lesson, let's say 1960. As quickly as she could, she would work it back to Fionn Mac Cool, you know? And so before we knew it, that's where we'd be, you know, and the wooing of Etain and, you know, the Brown Bull of Cooley and, you know, all of that stuff. We were steeped in that. I think all my siblings as well and all the kids I went to school with at the time would still remember those stories because she had a fascination. So they're there for a very long time. But in terms of writing, no, I came late to them. I mean, consciously. Like, I would have been in my mid to late 20s before I ever read the Greek plays. I think I might have done one in my degree in UCD, but I can't even remember it. We did quite a bit of Shakespeare, who I also love. But the Greek plays, no, late 20s. So
they started to feed in. I suppose that one of the early breakthrough plays was The May.
Yeah.
Which she's sitting waiting on her husband to constantly come home.
Yeah.
Touch of the Penelope's and Odysseus there.
Yeah, but sure, that never occurred to me, you know.
When you were writing, was it not there at all?
No, not at all. Not a bit of it. No, and Portia Coughlin, people say it's really Greek. But it's not. Except I probably had started reading the Greek plays and maybe in its form it might be a little bit. But not consciously, no. Bog of Cats, very consciously, was my riff on Medea. So I would say that's the first one I consciously sat down.
So it really was feeding in there in a very direct way, which was the third of those three plays.
Yeah.
So in the case of Bog of Cats, and so that we have the Medea story, jilted by Jason that causes the problem for her, and so your Hester Swain is the Medea character, jilted by the wonderfully named Carthage. What's Carthage's second name?
Carthage Kilbride.
Carthage Kilbride. Did you know somebody in Offaly called Carthage?
I knew a Carthage, and the experts tell me, you know, they made a big thing around his name being Kilbride, you know. And again, that never occurred to me.
Hello, the penny's just gone the whole way down in the slot machine up here for me as well.
What are you talking about? And Carthage had nothing to do with Hannibal and Africa, whatever. It was basically, there's a well called St. Carthage as well in Offaly. And I knew some boys around Offaly who were called Carthage. And I just thought it's a beautiful name.
So in it went.
Yeah.
And so that Medea structure... Was it simply that? Did it just give you a scaffold that got you through the play?
Yeah, absolutely. Took the blueprint and then ran with it and tried to make it fit in with what I thought was how it worked for me. And, you know, since now when I go at a Greek blueprint, I don't have any of that. But I think because it was the first one, I really wanted it to make sense for me. I don't know if it does, but it did for me at the time.
And did you feel, was it that you wanted to say the Irish, the stories of everyday life are now as big as Greek epics? They are Greek myths. That's what they are. Because she's an ordinary, in some ways, she's an ordinary woman, even though there's a lot of mythology happening all around her.
Yeah, very ordinary. And in a way, your life is as mythic and as mythical and as epic as you want it to be. If you want to live a small life, you can live a small life, but your imagination can be huge. Or if you want to live a big life, you can. We are our own myths. We're the lead in our own story. Unfortunately, we're not the lead in anyone else's story. This is where all the problems happen. But one can be one's own hero or heroine, and it keeps you going, you know. In the life of the imagination.
And in that life of the imagination, then, is some of you then is the hero that is Hester. Some of you is the hero that is Portia. Some of you is the hero that is the May.
Yes, but I'm also the demons as well, you know, because you can't just choose, you know. You have to be every character. You know, you can't say, oh, I like that one, I'll be that one. But there's a bit of, you know, all the devils are here as well. And I think that's one of the interesting things about writing plays. Well, I don't write novels, so I don't know what that's like. But writing plays is you have to be all of the characters when you're writing. So you have to see every side. So you have to love your monsters.
No judgment allowed.
No judgment allowed. No, none. That's for other people. You write it out from, and you have to give everyone their chance or their day out as they, you know, on stage. You cannot have your politically correct agenda, or you cannot have your personal opinion. Of course it'll infiltrate in ways you won't even recognise, but one would hope you would keep as much as that out.
So even in, like, you know, those early plays, famously, infamously, if you want, you know, we're talking about suicide, we're talking about incest, we're talking about rape within families, we're talking about infanticide. Does the fact that you have to see everybody's side, does that make it, I don't know if easier is the right word, but does it make it easier as the only one I can come up with to write those characters?
I think so. You know, I think you have to really invest. They say no tears in the writer, no tears in the audience. But I think there's also a point where, and Aisling was talking about that, getting it across. There's a certain temperature needed. And I'm not saying cold, but I'm talking about just bringing it down a little bit so others can hear it. Because if I do all the work, there's no work for an audience to do, or there's no work for an actor to do, or there's no work for a director to do. If I do most of the work but leave that space for the audience to listen, for the actor to create, for the director to have this overall vision of how it will best rise. So I think you have to be very, and that's why a lot of people don't know how to read plays. And it's one of my problems with theatre managements. Very few of them actually know how to read plays.
What's the problem? What are they not getting when they read?
Well, I think they're not imagining it from the writer's point of view or the actor's point of view or the director's point of view. They're looking at product. They're looking at their season. They're not seeing it case by case, play by play, piece by piece. And it becomes this commercial thing. And it becomes this thing that has to fit into what they see as their agenda, rather than letting the thing be itself.
So, I mean, quite recently then, there was the I can't think of the word, when you're the revival of On Raftery's Hill at the Abbey. And critically huge success. And anybody, I remember saying, I must go to that. And boom, it was over in like
2 weeks.
2 weeks.
Yeah.
So obviously, it sounds to me that that's a commercial decision. Is that frustrating?
Well, you know, I'm so long in the tooth now. I'm so grateful it got 2 weeks. So, and I understand there are other problems. It can't just be, you know, as I was saying, one can be the lead in one's own life. One is not necessarily going to set the world on fire. But it's not, I mean, I don't want it to be about, you know, whatever grievances I might have, because I think it's bigger than that. I think it's about allowing the individual, their space. And this corporate attitude to everything is killing us all. Like, for example, the threat for Lyric being taken off. I was away and I came back and I heard, did you hear the news? All my friends listen to Lyric all day. And it's on in our house all day. It's on in the car, it's on in the house. And these fantastic people who are bringing this incredible music and these stories to us, and the idea that that would be taken from us, it's like, okay, you're going to take this now. So it's like, you know, we get stuck, but the solution is not to cut its head off. It's to work with whatever the difficulty is, or to work around that, but to try you know, because that means a whole generation, new generation coming up, and my children love Lyric, that they're not going to have Lyric now if it's taken.
In fact, I think about, in the piece we're going to hear Aisling perform for us now, I don't know if you were listening to Rosalka, the Dvorak Opera, when you were writing this particular
John
piece.
John Kelly introduced me to Rosalka. Well,
there
program.
You go. Which is, she's a nymph who has to, if she wants to realise her love, she has to become a person, and therefore she dies. So it gets a mention within. Maybe would you give us the basic outline of Woman in Scarlet? We're talking about a woman on her deathbed here, woman with what, 8 or 9 children?
8 children, and she's dying too young, and she's very angry. But she's also not at this point, I think. Depends on how Aisling chooses to do it. But not angry at this point,
some
I think.
New direction.
I think she's very
little direction
she's
there.
Very philosophical now, I think.
No pressure, Aisling.
We don't belong here. There must be another Earth. And yet there was a moment when I thought it might be possible here. A moment so elusive it hardly worth mentioning. An ordinary day with the ordinary sun of a late Indian summer on the grass as I sat in the car waiting to collect the children from school. Rosalka on the radio, her song to the moon, Rosalka pouring her heart out to the moon, her love for the prince. Make me human, she sings. Make me human so I can have him. And something about the alignment of sun and wind and song on this most ordinary of afternoons stays with me. Though what it means is beyond me and what I felt is forgotten now. But the bare facts, me, the sun, the shivering grass, Rosalka singing to the moon. And I wonder, is this not the prayer each of us whispers when we pause to consider? Make me human. Make me human. And then divine. And I wonder, is it for these elusive prayers we are here, these half sentences that vanish into the ether almost before we can utter them? Living is almost nothing, and we brave little mortals investing so much in it.
That's Aisling McGuckin reading from Marina Carr's Woman in Scarecrow. We'll be back with the final part of our programme after this break. And we're back in the Project Arts Centre with not half enough time to talk about all the stuff that we want to talk about. We heard a bit from Woman in Scarecrow, Marina Carr, there just before the break. And 2006 was the first production of that in London.
You were in it.
Not a Woman in Scarecrow, no. It was the first production of Portia Coughlin. Keen to get that
up.
In, weren't you? I played neither woman nor scarecrow.
No. You played Raphael Coughlin.
I did.
Yeah.
That's enough said about that now. Because there's
you were
a new
very
production.
Good. Your hair was black.
I think blacker was the word you were looking for there. But there's a new production of Portia Coughlin coming up in 2020 with Ruth Negga in the Portia.
There is.
The role. Hecuba that is on here at the moment was first produced in London in 2015. And kind of struck me, the reason I mentioned Woman in Scarecrow, I think that was the first, while the production that we did of Portia had gone to London and played in the Royal Court, that Woman in Scarecrow was the first production that started in London. Is that becoming more and more of a reality that your plays are getting done there more than they're getting done at home?
Well, at the minute, yeah, but it all goes kind of in cycles. They just, I was very fortunate. I just met a few people that I connected with and they asked me to work with them. So Yael Farber, I've just done an adaptation of Blood Wedding for the Young Vic.
It's running currently, isn't it?
It's running currently at the Young Vic. And yeah, a couple of other things. And, you know, I love working on the island, but I also love getting off the island. The only thing I think about off the island is the island, but it's great. You can see it a bit clearer when you're away.
Is there a different attitude to your plays and to the productions of your plays in Britain? Of simply getting them put on. You talk to me about political will. Is there a different type of political will in Britain?
Well, no, it's market and there are more theatres. It's quite small here. You know, you're quite limited in the places you can go. So, you know, that Lynn at Rough Magic picked up Hecuba and decided to do it and actually doing it here, because I started out here in the Project Arts Centre, which is fantastic. And it's a bit like coming full circle. And it's just beautiful to be back here, like 30-odd years later, where I started out. There was a hole in the roof and there was water everywhere. But that's... And I love cycles. I love seeing things.
Well,
return.
I hope now this is only the beginning of another cycle rather than... Because you're talking there like it's the big...
So do I.
Full circle.
Yeah. No, I hope
we're
so.
Starting something rather than finishing something up. I can't believe that it's 2 minutes to 8 o'clock, and I know that you're mad keen that we hear another little bit from Cuevin, as keen as we all are. But let me sign off before we go to Cuevin. That's it from the Project Arts Centre for this evening. My thanks to Aisling McGuckin and Cuevin O'Rahilla for their performances. Cuevin about to give us another one shortly. Thanks also to Rough Magic and the Dublin Theatre Festival rather, and the Project Arts Centre for their hospitality this evening. Booking for Hecuba and other shows at this year's festival, you can go to the website dublintheatrefestival.ie. Ciarán Cullen and Jamie Doyle were in sound this evening. Paula Shields and Liam Murphy were the researchers. The programme was produced by Kay Sheehy. Back at base tomorrow night, John Creedon is on the way shortly. I leave you with Cuevin O'Rahilla right now, but let us say a major thank you also to Marina Carr.